I begin by paying my respects to the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional owners of the land in which we're meeting today. And I pay my respects to the elders, to the ancestors, and those who have come before us. And thank you to Alan Madden for your generous welcome, as always, to all of us to be on your country. Thank you to everybody for attending the launch of the latest Social Justice Report and Native Title Report. And these reports, as you're aware, were tabled out of parliamentary session on the 30th of April 2009. These are the fifth set of reports that I've completed, and possibly my last, as my current term as Social Justice Commissioner comes to an end in July. So can I take this opportunity to acknowledge the efforts of all of my staff and all the collaborators who have assisted me over the past 5 years in the preparation of what I call and what I consider very significant reports. Thank you all. Thank you to Cathy Branson, our President at the Australian Human Rights Commission, for your introduction. And thank you to John Borsick, as Representative of the Attorney General, the Honourable Robert McClellan, for your remarks and your presence here today. As some may know, the Attorney was to be here, but a Cabinet meeting to discuss the budget was called, and so he couldn't be here. But the willingness of the government to participate in this launch is indicative of the new partnership and new agenda for Indigenous Australians and the Australian government. And that brings me to the topic of today, new partnerships, a new agenda. We've seen some pretty momentous events in Indigenous affairs over the past year or so. Just a month ago, on the 3rd of April, the Australian government formally gave its support to the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. I describe this as a watershed moment in the Australian history, and I'm hopeful that it will guide better rights-based engagement with Indigenous Australians. On the 13th of February last year, we witnessed a national apology to the Stolen Generation, and this will go down as one of those "where were you at the moment, at the time" moments in Australian history. It still brings shivers down my spine to recollect the power of those few words and that short period of time that we were at Parliament House. And it's always a surprise to think that it could have happened a long time ago, but it's happened, and for that we're very grateful. We can't ignore the significant strides towards achieving Indigenous health equality with the government's commitments through the Close the Gap campaign. And of course, the exciting and dynamic process that is currently underway in work towards a new model for a national Indigenous representative body by the end of the year. And related to all of this, Indigenous Australians have also been active in the Australian government's human rights consultation led by Father Frank Brennan around the country at the moment. These developments are all part of laying the foundation of a new partnership with a new agenda, and that fills me with optimism for the future. Optimism inspires people to believe that a better future is possible. It is the antidote to complacency. It motivates people to get passionate and call for change. This spirit of optimism is reflected in this year's Social Justice and Native Title reports as well. The Social Justice Report argues strongly for a better deal in rights protection for Indigenous Australians, a decent standard of education for our remote students, comprehensive support for healing, to move beyond the apology, and urges sustained action to keep the Close the Gap campaign on track. The Native Title Report looks at positive, practical changes that could be made to the Native Title system in light of the ever-present issues of connection and continuity. The extinguishment of Native Title, rights and interests, and the looming threat of compulsory acquisition of Aboriginal lands. The Native Title Report also tackles the topical issues of climate change and water rights and Indigenous peoples. And can I acknowledge Kevin Smith, who will join us later on the panel when we discuss these issues in the Native Title Report in more detail. Optimism has been part of the last 12 months, but so too have fears of uncertainty as a global financial crisis has wreaked havoc across the world. The IMF has recently announced that $6 trillion the US, I assume, has simply vanished in the past 12 months. Although this amount of money seems unreal to most of us, it will have real consequences. There will be certainly more job losses, constrained government spending on services, and things will get harder for everyday Australians. It's not the boom time anymore. It would be naive to think that it wouldn't be more difficult to secure funding from government and also from government support for all Indigenous issues when we are competing with an ever-growing dole queue across Australia. And that old chestnut will come up again in some sections of the media and the community. Human rights are well and good when you can afford them, but in times of hardship they are a luxury that we can't afford. So despite the initial optimism, this is also challenging, and it will be challenged at a very crucial time to get our messages about Indigenous human rights priorities across to not only the government but to the whole population to gain their support. But I think the key to making our voices heard is to show that the human face of human rights, and that's what we must advocate for. So let me share some examples from the Social Justice Report. Human rights are not the exclusive domain of lawyers or institutions like the United Nations or indeed even the Australian Human Rights Commission. They affect everybody, everywhere, every day, the world over. Yet we have very minimal levels of rights protection in this country, and this is especially true for Indigenous peoples. And I'd also like to acknowledge Professor Larissa Berendt, who will be joining us on the panel later to explore these a bit further. We see the human face of this lack of rights protection when we look at the entrenched disadvantage that Indigenous Australians experience and what we all know as the 17-year life expectancy gap, which is a product of poverty and of disadvantage. So let's break it down a bit. The life expectancy of Indigenous men is only 59 years. Maybe there are some people in this room getting towards that age. Maybe there are people in the room whose parents are getting towards that age. Regardless, the inequality is a real human issue, and it's a real human rights issue for all of us. In the Social Justice Report, I call on a six-point plan to protect rights. One, the government should formally support and implement the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Two, a National Human Rights Act should be passed that includes specific protection of Indigenous rights. Three, constitutional reform should recognise Indigenous peoples in the preamble of the Constitution, as well as remove existing discriminatory provisions and replace them with a guarantee of equal treatment and non-discrimination. Four, a national Indigenous representative body should be established and processes put in place to ensure the full participation of Indigenous peoples in decision-making that affects all of our lives and our interests. Five, a framework for negotiations with Indigenous peoples should be developed to address the unfinished business of reconciliation. And six, a focus on human rights education be pursued to build a culture of human rights protection and respect. There are a lot of well thought out legal arguments and reasons in the report, and I won't go into them all now. There are also compelling human reasons. For instance, when we ask people to give one reason why the current rights protection are not sufficient, and this is particularly when they ask me, I like to remind them that the common law could not prevent the forcible removal of Indigenous children from their families, and it has since offered very little to redress the hurt of those people who were forcibly removed or stolen. And we must do everything we can to prevent the repeat of another stolen generation. We are still dealing with so much hurt and so much trauma today as it reverberates across the generations, creating destructive cycles of violence, abuse and despair. You only need to listen to the harrowing stories of stolen generations members. The stories of Indigenous women escaping violence, the stories of Indigenous people in custody who know about the thin line between victim and perpetrator. and the Indigenous children who carry the burden of all of these stories to know that we urgently need healing. And there are some wonderful examples of healing programs that really work, but they are often ad hoc and poorly funded. What is needed is a consistent, long-term support for the stolen generations, their families and communities. And for this reason, in the report, I've called for a nationally independent, Indigenous-controlled healing body that is responsible for developing and implementing a national Indigenous healing framework. And I welcome the government's commitment to establishing a healing foundation with the process led by Mae O'Brien and Gregory Phillips. And Greg is with us today and he'll participate on the panel. However, I'll just add a note of caution. Action should not be at the expense of proper consultation. And this is too important an issue to be rushed into and to get wrong through lack of real community engagement. Remote education is also something we can't afford to get wrong anymore either. I think a lot of Australians would be shocked to know that many Indigenous children living in remote communities only have a teacher come to teach them for 3 days a fortnight. And this would be even further shocked to know that these children are being educated in sheds and their tin sheds with dirt floors. Not exactly the same picture as I walked, and if any of us walked, just 10 minutes down the road to Ultimo Public School, or indeed if I ask you to anyone in this room to tell us about your children and to describe the school that your children attend. Yet all of these children have the same rights to education. When we look at the conditions in remote areas, it is no wonder that these children are lagging behind. Now Mick Dodson, the Australian of the Year, called for every child in Australia to be in a classroom by the next year. Like calling for Indigenous health equality in a generation, this too is an ambitious, but I think admirable task if we take the right approach. The social justice report shows a way forward. We need to get away from the educational fads that seem to dominate Indigenous education and the polarising arguments about whether remote children should be educated in their communities or in boarding schools far away from their communities. On that contentious point, I think we need to be unequivocal. It is not possible or practical to move all remote students to urban areas, and quality education must move to them. Locally based education is also an important way to show younger children in the community that they can achieve a higher standard of education because of that real important adage, you cannot be what you cannot see, and that's the legacy of sending our kids away to boarding schools. Can I also acknowledge two of our other panel members who are coming down to discuss remote area education, Mundawoi and Yalma Yunupingu from Yirrkala. But even the most whiz-bang evidence-based educational program is not going to work unless we have the foundation of community engagement and partnership. And there's that word again, partnership. The reason I keep returning to partnership is because they work. The Social Justice Report looks at some of the amazing successes that have grown out of strong community and school partnerships. And let me tell you about Guthalala. This is a school in remote Arnhem Land, not far away from Yirrkala, so remote that it was only connected to mains power last year. Up until 2006, the secondary students had no classroom and very limited access to resources like the internet. Yet despite this, last year, seven of the local students graduated from secondary school at year 12 level without having to leave their communities. And according to the teachers, it was the strength of the community support and partnership that made this possible. Partnerships have also been the cornerstone in the Close the Gap campaign on Indigenous health equality. Firstly, in 2006, a diverse group of Indigenous and non-Indigenous peak health bodies and human rights advocates initiated the campaign with me. The Australian government and the opposition embraced our objectives, signing a bipartisan statement of intent to close the life expectancy gap by 2030 and to provide the necessary primary health care to meet this goal by 2018. The hard work continues, and I'm happy to report that important steps have been taken, like the $1.6 billion commitment towards achieving health Indigenous Health Equality. The National Indigenous Health Equality Targets and the National Indigenous Health Equality Council. The next step is to develop a comprehensive, long-term, resourced national action plan to achieve our goals and to do it in genuine partnership with Indigenous people. Also on our panel today will be Dr. Nye Brown, who is one of the foundation members to the Close the Gap Steering Committee when we kicked off in March 2006. So let me turn to the big picture for the moment. As I said, the last 12 months have been characterised by optimism, but also uncertainty and fear. The uncertainty and fear have not just been because of the global economic crisis. We have a new sector looming: climate change. Indigenous people's access to water resources will also be significantly affected by climate change. And these two issues are of growing concern to Indigenous peoples nationally and internationally. Australia is waking up from a decade of denial about climate change. According to all the experts, Australia will be hard hit by climate change, and no more so than Indigenous peoples. As coastal and island communities confront rising sea levels, the inland areas become hotter and drier. Indigenous peoples are at risk of further economic marginalisation, as well as potential dislocation from and exploitation of their traditional lands, waters and natural resources. And the cruel irony, and it is a cruel irony, is that Indigenous peoples have the smallest ecological footprint but are being asked to carry the heaviest burden of climate change. And that ecological footprint is one that's recognised for Indigenous peoples worldwide. Now, one community carrying an immense burden are the Torres Strait Islanders. One of the most beautiful places in Australia, it is also one of the most threatened. Torres Strait Islanders are already noting visible changes, including unprecedented erosion, stronger winds, land accretion, increased storm frequency, rougher seas, and decreasing flora and fauna like turtles and dugong. And the predicted rises in sea temperatures, sea levels, and extreme weather conditions will potentially affect every aspect of life in the Torres Straits. For instance, we expect to see reduced availability of fresh water, inundation and destruction of infrastructure like housing, sewerage, power, roads and airstrips, greater risk of disease from flooded rubbish tips and insect-borne diseases like dengue fever and malaria, degradation of significant cultural sites and the inability to travel between islands. These things will profoundly affect the ability of these communities to enjoy many of the basic rights that other Australians take for granted, such as the right to life, health, food, water, culture, and a healthy environment. There is a real possibility that some communities will need to move to higher ground or relocate altogether to the mainland. For such a proud people with strong connection to land, and don't forget it was Eddie Mabo from the Moore Island who first won recognition for native title, it is a very sad prospect. If Indigenous people are going to be hard hit by climate change, it is only right that we have a seat at the table when it comes to working out climate change policy and planning. And this has not been happening to date, and we need to address it urgently. For this reason, I call upon the Australian Government to adopt a human rights-based approach that actively engages Indigenous peoples at every level of climate change, from planning right through to management. Indigenous people looked after the land for many thousands of years pre-colonisation. We have a traditional knowledge and proven land management and conservation practice and practices underpinned by a deep connection and respect for the land. Now it is again time for Indigenous people to have a central role in caring for our country. Indigenous people will be part of the solution to climate change. Reducing greenhouse gases and carbon abatement will rely heavily on Indigenous lands and waters. And I should remind everybody that at this stage, Indigenous people have control of about 20% of the land mass of Australia, and yet we don't have any say about how we're going to work with the challenge of climate change. To turn away from fear and uncertainty to optimism of our times, climate change can present opportunities for Indigenous communities. Programs like Caring for Country and National Parks Joint Management Partnership arrangements across Australia are a win-win situation for communities and for the environment. The Murray-Darling Basin is another hotspot under immediate threat from the impacts of climate change and access to water, but also a place where partnerships are being forged. The Native Title Report looks at the Murray-Lower Darling Rivers Indigenous Nations, where 10 traditional owner groups in the lower southern part of the Murray-Darling Basin provide an Indigenous voice on water management. They have provided substantial inputs into state and federal government agencies and have developed memorandums of understanding with government agencies around natural resource management. They are integral to promoting the health of the rivers and the communities that depend on the rivers, but they need to be listened to and respected more than currently they are. And Stephen Ross, an expert from that area, from the Murray Lower Darling Rivers Indigenous Nation, will be with us today also on the panel to discuss these matters further. So it's fitting that I finish with those examples of environmental partnerships because they show how intertwined the fates of Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians are. We share one country and we need to work together if we're going to manage climate change. Equally, we share one humanity and we need to work closer to achieve better human rights protections, a decent standard of education for all children, healing for stolen generations, and health equality, to name just a few. And I don't doubt that there are tough times and immense challenges ahead of us, but I am optimistic about the future and passionate about calling for an opportunity to work together and to work together towards change. We can only be strong as a nation if we work together to create a new partnership and a new agenda for Indigenous Australia. And remember that partnership brings respect, and from respect comes dignity, and from dignity comes hope. Thank you. Thank you.